Welcome to Boston Confidential, Beantown's true crime podcast. Boston is a great city, but there's more to it than the Freedom Trail and Fenway Park. There's a startling underbelly to the city, and Boston Confidential will take you on a guided tour of the hub of the universe, Boston, Massachusetts. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Boston Confidential. My name's Barry McGuire, and I'm your host. I'm a 20-year private investigator on the streets of Boston, and I help run a company called Impact Due Diligence Investigations. If you need anything in terms of investigative services, feel free to contact me at Impact. If I can't help you personally, I'll certainly direct you to the right person or agency. All right, guys, let's get to it. Just some housekeeping items as we typically do at the outset of each show. We had an excellent response to our three-part series on the Maura Murray case out of New Hampshire. Maura's case is heartbreaking and one of the most enduring mysteries in the New England region. Maura disappeared from New Hampshire in 2004 and hasn't been heard from since. There were a ton of issues surrounding the case, her relationship with her dad, her boyfriend, but I don't think any of that had anything to do with Maura's disappearance on that cold winter night. Quite frankly, I think the case would have been more likely to be solved if it had. But I think the problem here is this was a stranger on stranger crime, a crime of opportunity, if you will. And there's nothing connecting the person or people responsible for Maura's disappearance. Everything else was just outside noise, I think. Even if she was looking to run away, I don't think she got the opportunity to do so. Whatever happened, happened on that road. The dogs searching in the area lose Maura's scent right in the middle of the road. What I think happened, and I know I went over this a few times in the series, is Maura made a quick calculation. Do I want to get in trouble for an OUI, which I think would have kept her from her nursing career, quite frankly? Or do I get into a stranger's vehicle? And she did a quick calculation and made the wrong choice. She got into a vehicle with somebody she didn't know, and she was never heard from again. And I believe Maura Murray's father stated those sentiments quite eloquently when he said she was abducted by a local dirtbag, quote unquote. People think just because it's beautiful New Hampshire, there aren't local dirtbags. There are. They're everywhere. And this person saw an opportunity, and they took it. The other theories, guys, on that case, running away, perhaps that was the goal. She didn't get there. One of the strange things about the case is all the question marks around it and the trolling, the immense trolling on social media. The majority of it was just cruelty for cruelty's sake. Such a sad, sad situation. Hopefully Maura will be found one day and laid to rest in consecrated ground. But there's a lot of land up there in the White Mountains. Also, guys, there have been some developments in the Karen Reed saga. Fox 25 out of Boston did a brief segment on John O'Keefe's death. They've mostly confirmed the fact that there is a federal grand jury, that the grand jury has interviewed numerous people, but none in terms of law enforcement or the district attorney's office in Norfolk County. That led to speculation that the targets of this federal grand jury are, in fact, law enforcement and the district attorney's office. A few days after this aired, the district attorney, Michael Morrissey, produced some rambling interview where he basically played Jimmy the Dunce, and he says, I don't know why the federal government is investigating this case. And during the Fox 25 segment, it came to light that Michael Morrissey had likely sent a letter to federal prosecutors asking that the investigation be transferred out of Massachusetts for some reason of conflict of interest or something like that. It was super lame. And it just made me think, man, the professionalism at the prosecution level is very wanting. And he just looked like a rumpled bag of clothing. And I mean, nobody tells that guy, go get a haircut, get a new suit, you're going on television. I mean, we don't deserve that as citizens. We don't deserve your best, really. And then you come up with this Jimmy the Dunce nonsense. Oh, I don't know why they would be doing that. Well, everybody else knows why, you jackass. It's just total amateur hour, and it's frustrating. You need the prosecutors to be the good guys who have higher ethical standards. And now a handful of them, I think, are going to be indicted in this case. And it's going to be difficult from this podium, from right here, from me. And I get it, I'm no one. But I support the police. I support prosecutors. I did think they were the good guys. How do I do that going forward? The only pause I have in this, and I mentioned it in our interview with Aiden Carney of Turtle Boy News, where hoping the FBI comes riding in as white knights. Do a little research on the FBI in Boston in years past and currently in Washington, D.C. right now. I'm not impressed. Are you? And just one final thing on the Karen Reed saga. Aiden Carney had produced all that information before Fox 25. And he tells me he's grateful for Fox 25 going forward with the story. But Aiden is responsible for all that information. They confirmed it. And for some reason, people think Fox 25 has more credibility. And so there it is. But come on, this could be a 2-hour special on Dateline. And I think it will be because Dateline was sniffing around the courthouse and D&E Pizza in Canton. And I think when this case ends, you're going to see this on Dateline. It's not going to look good for the Canton police, the state police, and Michael Morrissey's office. All right, guys, another opener that was a little longer than I expected. But man, the Karen Reed thing is just taking on a life of its own. It is literally the strangest case I've ever seen. All right, guys. If you need me, email is the best platform. People are still reaching out on social media. Email is the platform to get a hold of me. Barry@BostonConfidential.net. That's Barry@BostonConfidential.net. All right, guys. This week, we're talking about the Charlestown, Massachusetts infamous code of silence and the armed robbery crew that kind of personified what was going on in Charlestown in the 90s. Now, for all you guys out there who are not from the New England region, and those numbers are growing, I feel like I need to give an accurate description of Charlestown. Charlestown is the section of Boston that was portrayed in Ben Affleck's movie, The Town. It's a great heist film. I urge everybody to see it. Very good movie. But it was kind of portrayed as that was going on now in Charlestown, right? Or in current times. But that really ended, I don't know, at the tail end of the 90s, early 2000s. But Charlestown is kind of a strange setup because it's 1 square mile, guys. It is Boston's smallest neighborhood by far, I believe. It housed about 18,000 people, and it's located, if you're coming from north of the city, going south into the city, Charlestown is, you can see it right off the Tobin Bridge, and it was a pretty vibrant community. It always has been. It was largely Irish-American. I believe in the 90s when this story I'm going to tell you about today, the Code of Silence armored car robberies, when that happened, it was about 96% white. It was a tough area, a lot of poverty. There's two large housing projects in Charlestown, and that's a lot for such a small community. I believe one they used to call Newtown, and there was an older and more expansive public housing project. I forget its full name. You know, they try to always give these housing projects these beautiful names. The older project, man, it was horrific. It just was. And everybody who talks about white privilege, I think they would have done well to walk through Charlestown, Massachusetts, in that project back in the 90s. It was just poverty. And drugs have always been a massive problem in Charlestown. But it was a cohesive neighborhood. They really stuck together. And there was a code, not just of silence, but of your fellow townies. That's what they called each other, townies. And to be honest with you, they weren't to be effed with. They were tough guys. They were tough people. I had friends from Charlestown. I was from the other side of the city in South Boston. Unfortunately, Charlestown and South Boston was kind of looked at as shanty Irish. Charlestown more so than Southie, I think. And it was just due to the grinding poverty. The Navy Yard is in Charlestown. It still is. And that's where the USS Constitution is docked, if anybody's been there during these school trips. And that's a beautiful section. That's kind of gentrified, a gentrified section of Charlestown. But at the time, it was kind of a working seaport. And there was a lot of longshoremen. That was a lot of work in the neighborhood, is unloading ships and stuff like that. But as the terminals in South Boston became more modernized, more shipping went over there than it did to Charlestown. And it's kind of just grinding poverty. But on the other hand, there's a ton of beautiful brownstones. And up by the Bunker Hill Monument, now those houses are selling for $4 or $5 million. Before, townies would have those triple deckers in their families for generations. So I guess in the 1990s, guys, and I guess into the 2000, mid-2000s, it was shanty Irish. Also, guys, as I said, I grew up across town in South Boston, and it was known to us in South Boston that Charlestown raised bank robbers. It was a common joke. They also seemed to have a penchant for PCP, which was called angel dust back then. Charlestown seemed to be the center of PCP as well, which always struck me as odd. But strangely enough, there wasn't a lot of street crime in Charlestown. And they would get angry if you did crime in their town, kind of like South Boston in that regard, I guess. But it was pretty safe to walk the streets. It wasn't like that. But if you were a bank teller in a suburban community, you didn't want to see anybody from Charlestown walking through the door. And that's kind of the story I'm going to tell you about today. That in this code of silence that, I don't know, went on for about 50 years or so, I guess, in Charlestown. And the only thing to really cure Charlestown was gentrification. There used to be a term called yuppies, young, upwardly mobile professionals or something like that. And that's a term from the early 90s, I think. And they kind of went in and bought up those beautiful old homes in Charlestown. And the old shanty Irish picked up stakes and moved to the North Shore, I guess. Regardless, there's not a lot of townies actually left within Charlestown right now. And there were a lot of reasons for that. Also, guys, during that time, there wasn't much to draw you to Charlestown if you didn't live there. You know, I think there was one grocery store and no real restaurants in the area that would make you say, oh, let's go over to Charlestown. So that has changed. I have to say there's a restaurant scene there and it's pretty upscale, just minus the Irish, I think. All right, guys, let's get to this heist. And there's a series of heists involved here. But the one I'm going to tell you about today was kind of the exclamation point on a series of robberies conducted by this same crew in Charlestown. During this particular robbery in New Hampshire, Hudson, New Hampshire, two guards were murdered, and it changed how people were viewing this crew and the robbing of armored cars and banks. And people, they kind of went against the townies on it. And just because of these two working class guys, very nice guys, cut down in the prime of their lives for no reason. They were just working. They're working stiffs, just like the working stiffs in Charlestown. So what happened? Why did they have to be shot? Guys, the guards' names, the first guard was Wes Anderson. He was 57. The second one was Ron Normandu, and he was 52. They both had families, both reported to be basically straight arrows, just working stiffs. Certainly didn't deserve what happened to them. All right, so let's jump back into the Wayback Machine. It's August 25th, 1994. And guys, we're in Hudson, New Hampshire, and Hudson, New Hampshire is about a solid hour from Boston, Massachusetts. It is east, I believe, of Nashua, New Hampshire, by just a few miles. The Hudson-Nashua metropolitan area is pretty well populated, but just after Hudson, it gets pretty rural in New Hampshire. And at that time, I believe Hudson would have been pretty rural. I guess you'd probably call it suburban now, but in the 90s, it was, you know, probably described best as being a rural community. Nashua would have been described as, you know, suburban. But regardless, between 9:10 a.m. and 9:30 a.m., I've seen the time this robbery started as both 9:10 and 9:30. But in that time frame, anyways, at the National Federal Savings Bank off of Route 1 in Hudson, New Hampshire, a Northeast armored car service pulls up to the bank. Inside was Wes Anderson and Ron Normandu. And the bank gets serviced, and the guard is coming out with the large sack of money. And as the guard went in, a minivan pulls up alongside of the armored car. The driver doesn't really take notice because it is Hudson, New Hampshire, and it's part of their route. Nothing seemed out of the ordinary. But when the guard came out, three men leapt from the minivan. At least two of them were concealed in the back. It was one of those minivans where you could remove the seats, and I believe they were secreted in the back. And they get the drop on the guard who is getting back in. And almost immediately, a scuffle breaks out, and one of the guards is shot. And almost simultaneously, the door is open, and they shoot the driver dead in the head right away. So you've committed two murders in, what, 10 seconds. One of the robbers gets in the driver's seat of the armored car and pulls off. The other two assailants get back into the minivan and also drove off. This probably took, I don't know, 40 seconds or so, but it was like a gunfight. It was a couple gunshots out there, and so the police were on their ass. It would come out later that both of the guards, actually the whole company, had been notified by the FBI about this spate of armored car and bank robberies in the area. The number was absolutely astronomical. And I'm sure they talk amongst themselves, if somebody tries to rob us, I'm not going to comply. I wish they had. I don't know what actually went wrong here. But man, it went all kinds of wrong, and it spun out against the gang, really. And I'll tell you a little bit about the perpetrators. We may do this in two episodes, guys, because there's just so much information. But this robbery goes sideways right from the beginning. And it was a massive score. There was $500,000 in cash in whatever the guards were carrying and in the back. They ended up leaving like thousands of dollars in, you know, small denomination bills and change and all that, checks in the armored car. But public opinion, man, people were just sick of this crap. They just were. And now there's two dead working stiffs, you know, and people were angry about it. And this would be one of the reasons that the code of silence in Charlestown would be broken. Because just like in their community, you have workaday guys, just like these guards who are working for the bank or the armored car company, you know. So it's hard to have sympathy or admiration for these robbers, right? And we all like a good heist story, but it's usually never as it appears. It's usually a bunch of drug addicts doing these robberies. And it would come out later that there was certainly this element there, you know. And these were no Robin Hoods we were dealing with here. And this was the final robbery. And man, a career that spanned over a decade and took millions of dollars apparently was never enough. And the FBI certainly knew. But don't forget, we're in the mid-90s, early to mid-90s. You know what was going on in Boston with the FBI then, right? Wholly owned by organized crime. But okay, back to this specific robbery. The minivan drives off and the armored car drives off and bank tellers who look out the window see a white sedan also following in what is now this caravan, and it appears to be involved in this robbery. They call the police. Hudson police are there pretty quickly, but just not quick enough. They start doing an area search for the armored car. But as I've said, after Hudson, New Hampshire, this gets pretty rural, you know. So a grizzled old patrolman is out patrolling the area looking for these obvious murderers, right? At a minimum, the police knew the guards had been shot because witnesses told them so. And a cop is going down a rural logging road, and he can hear what appears to be a diesel engine still running. Does some reconnaissance and comes upon the armored car. It's still running. The cop calls it in, and now it's all hands on deck. But before the whole cavalry gets there, the cop and some others who had just arrived wanted to see what was going on in the armored car because the guys were still missing. I guess they really didn't know if it was a murder. They knew it was a shooting, right? So they knew there could be injured personnel in the boxcar, in the armored car itself. And that would prove to be true, but they had to go up there in almost like a SWAT-like fashion with just a few guys, no body armor, nothing like that. They get up to the truck. It's been pilfered, that's obvious. And they find the bodies of both security guards, Ron and Wes, within the vehicle. There were some tire tracks in the area, and the cops were smart enough not to have the rest of the police department come in that way. They took plaster casting of the tire treads, and that would come into play later. That would be a big piece of evidence going forward. But the Hudson police, man, they were a small town and they were kind of overwhelmed. The FBI got on it pretty quickly. New Hampshire State Police assisted as well. But after this robbery, and this is kind of an aside, the Hudson Police Department went to semi-automatic handguns, having assault rifles or at least shotguns in all of their vehicles, because if they had pulled up on this robbery, I think there would have been a tremendous shootout and the Hudson police would have just been outgunned. So I guess that's one good thing that came from this, if you can even say that. The witnesses described the robbers as having masks on and what appeared to be assault-style rifles. So I think they definitely would have been outgunned. And as the cops surround the armored car, they go up. They have one ballistic shield among three cops, but the cops feel like they can't wait for SWAT to arrive because there was obviously a shooting. And they get up to the armored car, and they can see Wes Anderson, and he is dead on the floor of the armored car. They go over to the maroon minivan, and they find the body of Ron Normandu, and he is dead as well. And they had taken him into the minivan. I believe the struggle started with Ron. I don't know if he resisted, but these guys leapt out of the maroon minivan when Wes opened the door. There's a push button, and he pushes the button. Now it's open, and they go up to Ron with the guns. I don't know if he resists or it was the plan to just shoot this cat, but they throw him into the minivan. One of the robbers gets into the armored car and shot Wes. So, I mean, again, I think I said it was like 40 seconds. It may have been less than that. And the cops end up finding that, and it's now a double homicide, and everybody knows it. And they alert the Massachusetts State Police and naturally the FBI. You know, for all the talk about this crew being a professional bank robbery, armored car robbery crew, I don't know. This went badly pretty quickly. And they found a mask in the armored car after they finally got it open. And they theorized that somehow the robber had taken his mask off and could have been identified by Wes Anderson. That's the theory. And he had been shot once in the leg and was bleeding profusely, but the kill shots were, I think, two bullets to the head. So it was a pretty brutal scene. They recover the mask, and that will go in for DNA testing. It was still early in the process of DNA, but it would bear fruit. That piece of evidence would certainly bear fruit later, as would the plaster casting of the getaway car. There were two vehicles where the armored car was recovered. It was the van that the robbers arrived in and put Ron Normandu in, and the armored car itself. So naturally, the cops come up with the theory that there was another vehicle present as the getaway vehicle, and hence those tracks. And that would prove to be true. Some of the best evidence in this case was developed pretty quickly. The mask, certainly among them, the tire prints, and they ascertained that there had to be a third vehicle, and they interviewed a mechanic with a shop nearby who reported that there was a truck running in the nearby woods. At one point, he was actually going to go see if they needed help, but got caught up with something else, and he was lucky he didn't. But he stated that it was a rider moving truck, the one that has like the cab right over the engine, you know what I mean? And it was a yellow box truck, yellow rider truck. There's a million of them. I'm sure you're familiar with it. For whatever reason, in the news accounts, they don't really call it a rider truck, but I'm going to say it's a rider truck. And at that point, they track the person who rented a rider truck down, and naturally it was a tally. This has to be the most stupid mistake I've ever seen in a bank robbery. These guys were getting sloppy. I'm assuming it has to do with drugs and alcohol, because the rental agreement comes back to a Patrick McGonigal, a known townie enforcer and robber. And the jig was mostly up at that point, but they continued to put it together, and they'd put together a lot more. And the code of silence, if it ever really existed, broke down pretty quickly. Now, that description of the rider truck and how it all came about, that took more time. That was a brief version I've given you. But McGonagall goes to return the truck personally, and this is the real-life version, guys, of robbing the bank with your Charlestown High School hockey jacket on with your name on the side. And it kind of gives me a chuckle if it wasn't for these two brutal homicides, right? Jeez. But when they get on to McGonagall, you know, the FBI knows who he is. The Boston police know who he is. Everybody knows who he is. He was about 57 at the time of the robbery. But things would get even worse for this crew. And the next shoe to drop was the white car that I had mentioned during the robbery that witnesses inside the bank said appeared to be a part of that three-vehicle convoy, the minivan, the armored car, followed by this white vehicle. And that was found in metropolitan Boston, set ablaze. And whomever lit this vehicle on fire was an absolute idiot, because there was a ton of evidence, including a Boston Bandits shirt in the trunk. Now, the trunk was shut, so that means there's not a lot of airflow through that. And most of the car burnt, but the trunk was mostly intact because there was no airflow. And there was a ton, and I mean a ton of evidence in this vehicle, in the trunk. And to call these guys professionals, they just seem to be drug-addled alcoholics to me. And I know they're probably still kind of cherished in Charlestown today if there are any townies left, but man, this was just dumb. All right, guys, I think I'm going to leave you there. I gave you one of the robbers' names. If you're from Charlestown, I know you know the others. But this case goes badly quickly. It would turn brother against brother in Charlestown, and the code of silence would be broken. And I guess that had a lot to do with all this prison time stacked upon this crew. It would turn out that this was just the last in a series of robberies. I'm going to tell you more about those in next week's episode. We'll do a part two. I'll finish with this robbery and how it goes in court. Doesn't go well for the townies, I'll tell you that. And we'll go from there, all right? If you need me, email is the best platform, Barry@BostonConfidential.net. That's Barry@BostonConfidential.net. I'm going to get on to part two in this case. It's an interesting one, and we'll go from there. Otherwise, I'll see you on the flip side.